Dave Taffet here in the studio with Laron Landis and the late Patty Fink. Our guest today is
Cleve's looking.
You have to know Patty. Patty, how early did you get here?
I was here like at 10:30.
She was.
It was amazing.
Oh, I you know, I got a text from her flying down 30. I'm on my way. Like, really?
Okay, so we're at a Garland City Council.
Two wheels.
You know, this week was one of the first times the three of us did something together. We all went to a Garland City Council meeting together.
My first time ever.
Laron and I were there 6:45 before it said.
Yes.
Patty walks in on the dot 20 after 7.
We're not going to speak for a while.
As it turned out.
It turns out that tattoo parlors are far more controversial than queers.
Apparently.
That's true, because the mayor came to talk to the gay people afterwards, not to the tattoo people. Our guest today is Cleve Jones, who is just shaking his head.
Like, what did I get myself into?
What the hell did I get into today? Welcome, Cleve.
Thanks.
For anyone who doesn't know who Cleve is, if you didn't see the film Milk, Cleve is in the film. A character playing Cleve is in the film. You were the technical director of the film?
Historical consultant.
Don't you hate that? I always get called about historical things here in Dallas, too.
Because you're old.
Thank you. And so are you. Cleve is best known, though. He was an intern in Harvey Milk's office, and he's best known for creating the NAMES Project, the AIDS Memorial Quilt. Let's just start off. How did the quilt come about?
Well, the quilt is actually connected to the story of Harvey Milk. Harvey was really kind to me. I was kind of a idiot street kid in San Francisco, and I was one of many young people that he mentored and helped and encouraged. And when he was killed, you know, it was devastating to me. I actually was one of the people who found his body after he was shot on November 27th, 1978. And anyone who has seen the film Milk or the documentary, The Times of Harvey Milk, has seen the footage of the incredible spontaneous candlelight march that occurred that night. And we reenact it every year on November 27th. So in 1985, a few days before the annual tribute to Harvey Milk and George Moscone, the death toll from HIV hit 1,000 in San Francisco. And it was, of course, all in our little neighborhood.
Sure.
And I imagine many of your listeners have visited the Castro. It's a very compact neighborhood. And I remember standing at the corner of Castro and Market and looking around and realizing that those 1,000 had all lived and died within 6 blocks of where I was standing, but there was no evidence. And, you know, we were all kind of struggling with that. You know, how do we grieve together as a community? And also, how do we warn the world about what's coming? And so that night, as people marched, I had placards and blank cardboard and sacks of magic markers, and I had people write down the names of their friends and neighbors and colleagues who had died. And we marched to City Hall with our candles, as we always do, and then I had everybody go another couple blocks to the Federal Building, and I'd hidden ladders in the shrubbery, and we distracted the police and climbed up and taped these names to the Federal Building wall. And I looked at it, and this sort of patchwork, and I thought it looked like some kind of crazy quilt. And when I said the word quilt, I thought of my grandma, my great-grandma back in Bee Ridge, Indiana, and it was such a, you know, middle American traditional family values sort of symbol. And I happen to believe in traditional family values and want them to apply to me and my family. So right. That was the idea.
Have you seen the quilt, Laron?
Oh, yes.
Okay, what did you think when you saw it?
I was just astounded how big it was, how many. So how were you able to assemble a team to get to even start getting the quilts together?
You know, it was such a weird experience because I could see it in my head so clearly, but I'm not an artist, and I certainly can't sew. And I just kind of walked around with this picture in my head for about a year, and I talked to everybody about it, and without exception, everybody said it was the stupidest thing they'd ever heard of. Mm-hmm. And then I called a meeting. I rented a big hall, and I borrowed money and I put out posters and did everything I could think of to get people to show up, and only two people showed up. But one was named Cindy McMullen, affectionately known as Gert, mm-hmm. and the other was named Jack Castor, and Gert is still sewing the quilt together.
And Gert was here one time when we had a big showing.
Yeah, I'm sure she was, and she's still with the quilt. And
so did she move to Atlanta?
Yes, she moved to Atlanta, and but you know, it was the sort of thing where once we had a few examples, then people could get it. But when you tried to describe it to people without it, before it existed, people just didn't get it.
Right.
And it seemed very complicated and very, some people thought it was very morbid. But I just kept thinking about how I had this picture in my head of people sitting on the floor in living rooms and church basements and community centers and sharing stories about their friends who'd passed. Mm-hmm. And I had a hope that the process of working with their hands to create something beautiful while telling the stories would be therapeutic, because for anybody who lived through that era, you know, what was happening was that people were shutting down. They were so overwhelmed by the grief and misery of the situation that they were really becoming paralyzed by it. And we couldn't afford to be paralyzed. We had to find a way to heal and keep fighting back. And then I saw, you know, as great evidence, a tool for the media to look beyond the statistics. People were talking about, you know, who was getting it and what kinds of people were getting it. But these were individual human beings that had families and people who loved them. And I thought of it as a weapon against the government, that, you know, it was designed to be on the mall, to be evidence to the House of Representatives and the Senate and the White House, as to the, you know, these are the consequences of your failures. Mm. So it worked. And then once people saw it, once a small piece of it existed, then everybody wanted to be part of it and wanted to make sure their sons and daughters and neighbors and friends were included.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever get too many? Was there a limit of how many people could submit a quilt?
Oh, no, it's still growing. And anybody who's listening who wants to create a panel, they can go to aidsquilt.org, and there's instructions there. It's very simple. Please don't use glue. Understand it's going to be folded and refolded often, but it's still going on and still growing, though mm-hmm. happily not at the rate that it was growing. You know, we think of quilting very much as an American folk art, but there's similar traditions all over the world, so the quilt has been taken up in many different cultures all over the place.
Sure.
I think it's just incredibly, I mean, the times that I've been able to honor to see panels of the quilt, and they have had traveling exhibitions of the quilt, small subsets of panels. It's so poignant, I think, to see them, for those who've not only made them, but those who are seeing them, to really take it all in, and so cathartic for those who make them. But I remember talking with a woman one time who said, she goes, there's just not enough room. Mm-hmm. Not enough room for the stories. It's not enough room for the love. And I'm getting mm-hmm. choked up about it now, but it was such an amazing time of enormous loss, and yet such great memories. Do they still evoke in you?
Oh, yeah. It's
thoughts and feelings?
You know, I'm still traveling a lot, and I often show up for these smaller displays. It's been a long time since we've displayed it in its entirety, and that will probably never happen again. But I came up with the size for each panel. Each panel is 3 feet by 6 feet, because I kept going back to that moment when I was standing at the corner of Castro and Market and realizing that 1,000 had died within a couple blocks of where I was standing. And I remember thinking, you know, Castro Street's beautiful. It's restored Victorians and cafes and restaurants and bars. You don't know that you're in the middle of this war zone. And so I came up with the panels being 3 by 6 because I wanted it to illustrate the amount of ground that would be covered if all of the corpses were lined up. And and hoped that it would be enough space on the fabric so people could tell stories. And
some of them really do tell the story beautifully. Yeah. Some of them are nothing more than the person's name or their name and, you know, 1960 to 1982. You know, and you see it's a 22-year-old person who died of AIDS. But some of them really do tell the story beautifully. A number of the ones from the chorale have music all over them. And, you know, really they evoke something that the person did. You can't tell a person's whole story on one 3x6 panel, but you can tell something beautiful to remember. Every time I see the panel, one of the panels, and usually like for the Lone Star Ride, the closing ceremony involves walking in several of the panels, usually 6 to 10 panels. And every time I see pieces of the quilt, because they're usually local panels, I always go, I had forgotten this person. Mm-hmm. Another one, him, they worked for me at my travel agency that I had in the early 90s. Or there was one panel, I was in tears the last Lone Star Ride I did. Everybody else is walking in, and they're proudly walking in that they completed the ride, 100-mile ride, and, you know, raised good money for the AIDS organizations here. And I'm like, you know, I'm just in tears. And, you know, so everybody came over to me afterwards, and I said, do you understand who these people are? I said, look at this panel. This is the original Cedar Springs. This is the person who created the Roundup. This is the person who created tape lenders. This is the person who created, and one store after another that people just didn't know. You know, and it's like when I'm walking there, I'm walking among my friends. It's haunting. I mean, it is just haunting for me to walk through the panels. When I was in Washington for the last big quilt display, I forgot who I was talking to or whatever, and you know, and I said, well, that's my partner's quilt over there, whatever. It was right near where we were. And he said, would you like to read some names? Reading names. It didn't matter that I didn't know most of the names, but every once in a while I came up to one, so I'm reading, you know, the names just one after the other, and then it's because
nobody
of somebody
ever gets
that I knew
through their list without crying.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a powerful tool to me, and I was never, I was one of the ones who would have, when you suggested this, I would have said, quilt. I would have. It wasn't until I saw it.
Even though the quilt is still going on today, obviously, there because of the advances in drugs, we're not losing as many people, as near as many people to AIDS that we did in the 80s. Is that kind of bittersweet for you?
Well, it's not bittersweet. It's a great triumph of medicine and science and political activism, and it came at great cost. And many people had to devote most of their lives to make that happen. But it's only in the West, or the global North, as I guess we're calling it now. But people are still dying. And we're aware that people are dying in Africa because they don't have access to treatment. People are dying in Mississippi and Oregon because they don't have access to treatment. But most of the deaths, I believe now in our country, are can be stopped. Most of the people that are passing away now usually have other issues going on, in particular crystal meth addiction. But I'm very concerned about a new reality for the next generation. And first of all, I mean, you know, it's heartbreaking to know that there's another generation. And as a gay man, I feel a lot of love and concern for my younger brothers. And I'm interacting with a lot who are HIV positive. And this new generation is less likely to get tested. Once tested, they're much less likely to reveal their status. They're much less likely to access services. And they're really afraid to get tested, and they lack the sense of solidarity that was so strong in my generation. And
even for the ones who will get tested, you know, fortunately, we've talked about this on the show a lot. The ones who will get tested, they have this idea that even if they do test positive, it's not that big a deal. I can just pop a pill and I'll be okay.
Well, I think that is I think that's true to some extent, but I also think that there's a whole new kind of stigma that's been attached to the disease. So that for my generation, of course, there was a horrendous stigma attached to HIV/AIDS, and that stigma was the stigma of homosexuality. But and I know when I was infected. I know exactly when I was infected. It was almost 3 years before we heard anything about it. So, and I hear myself saying those words like it makes me better. And this is disgusting. So young people now, when they test positive, are subjected to this new kind of stigma, which sounds like, what, are you on drugs? What? Everybody knows. Everybody knows how it's spread. Everybody knows how to protect themselves. Well, that's not true. Not everybody knows. And if you grow up in any number of places in this country, in school districts that are controlled by right-wing Christian fundamentalists...
Fortunately, we don't have that here.
Right. You know, I mean, it's amazing the ignorance that is out there. And then also, young people make mistakes. And we also have a real issue with drugs and alcohol in our community, which lead to mistakes. Right. And so another thing that's happened is that transmission has been criminalized. So there's when people think when they're weighing out do I want to get tested or not, we're kind of tipping the scale against it because we require so much of them when they get that news. And the criminalization issue, I think, is really scary. I have had young people say to me that they don't want to get tested because then they'll have to reveal their status. Mm-hmm. That's a mess. Mm-hmm. Especially when there's no, you know, there's hardly any job protections. There's, you know, maybe Obamacare is going to at least take one of those worries off people's tables. But I'm real concerned about it. And
do you know how many states actually have criminalized transmission?
I don't, but there's a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And they vary from state to state. In California, for example, you have to prove intent, I think.
Uh-huh.
And also, another part of that is that there's a great deal of sexual behavior that poses no risk of transmission at all. So
it
puts people in such a conundrum. When do I reveal? Mm-hmm. Do I reveal when I date you? You know, do I have to tell you before I kiss you? Mm-hmm. You know, right. What?
Sure.
It's frustrating.
We need to take a break. We're talking to Cleve Jones. He created the NAMES Project, the AIDS Memorial Quilt, and most people know what it is. You know, I don't need to say much more about it than that. I hope most people know what it is. Most of our listeners would. But you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. We'll be back with more right after this.
KNON and Beyond Bows and Arrows' fifth ever benefit powwow is coming Saturday, October 5th. It's a free admission powwow with raffles, auctions, Indian food, arts and crafts, as well as raffle dances and spot dances. Vendor space is available. The fifth ever KNON benefit powwow takes place at Four Winds Park, located at 5380 East Highway 199 in Springtown, Texas. MCs for the powwow will be KNON's own Albert O'Crow and Harold Rogers. All drums and princesses are welcome. Vendor setup is at noon. Gourd dance starts at 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. A free supper break from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. and intertribal dancing from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. For vendor space or more information on the powwow, call 972-835-1590. Once again, 972-835-1590. Come experience a traditional old-style benefit powwow Saturday, October 5th.
The Fair Housing Act prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, national origin, disability, and familial status. A message from HUD in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance. The only way to stop housing discrimination is to report it. HUD.gov/fairhousing or 1-800-669-9777. A public service message from HUD in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
This is Alex Hanselka, and you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM, Dallas.
I just thought I could screw it.
We're just talking.
We're back.
We're back. We're having a discussion here. So
We never stop talking here on Lambda Weekly.
This is Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with LaRon Landis, the late Patty Fink, and our guest is Cleve Jones.
And we were talking about the quilts, and they can be seen at the Cathedral of Hope. 32 panels.
32 panels.
32 panels are there.
And I will be there tomorrow morning. early.
Speaking of services, you're going to actually be at the Peace Chapel, which is right across from, it's on the same campus. You'll be there at 1 o'clock if somebody would like to meet you. They're asking for a $5 donation for that. And at what time this evening? 5 o'clock this evening. That's a cocktail party with Cleve. So if you would like to, if you'd like to meet him, talk to him, drink with him.
Right.
What else are you doing?
But that's enough.
Okay.
But you know what else is amazing about what you started is it doesn't just didn't start and stop here in America. Other countries have picked up with their own quilts.
Yeah, I didn't expect that. I had a surprise guest recently, Mariela Castro, the niece of Fidel Castro and the daughter of the current president of Cuba, came to visit San Francisco and came to visit me and told me about the quilt that they have in Cuba. In 2000, I spent time in South Africa and got to work with the people that were doing the South African quilt. There's a quilt in Singapore. There's a quilt in Thailand. There's a Euro quilt that has sections from every country in Europe. So it's been very effective. But
there's an Israeli quilt?
Yes, there's an Israeli quilt. And we had people that took sections of the quilt to Israel and also to the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. So it's and I've traveled with it all over the world, and I've been to all 50 states with it, and everywhere it works. But you know, if there's any young people listening, I don't know who listens to this show, but if there's young people listening to it, I would like them to know that everybody told me it was the stupidest thing they'd ever heard of, and I was sure that they were incorrect, but for about a year, nobody encouraged me. Nobody believed in it. And so, you know, I think that's an important lesson, that if you have something in your heart that you know you're supposed to do, and everybody tells you that it totally sucks, please ignore them and go ahead and do what you're supposed to do, because it works.
Here's one of the most powerful quilt panels. It was a panel from here in Dallas, and it'll probably be at Cathedral, because I know this panel is usually kept here in Dallas. It's just in block letters, black letters on white. And what Dwayne wrote, and the person who died made this panel, actually he didn't, but he made the original of this panel himself. And it says, "My name is Dwayne Kearns Puryear. I was born on December 20th, 1964. I was diagnosed with AIDS on September 7th, 1987 at 4:45 p.m. I was 22 years old. Sometimes it makes me very sad. And I have trouble reading this. I knew Dwayne. I made this panel myself. If you're reading it, I am dead." Now, here's what happened.
Dwayne took this panel. I remember when that came in.
Yeah, Dwayne took this panel, and he brought it to Washington to one of the first showings of the quilt. And he was diagnosed in 1987, so I think the showing was that year? When was there?
87 was the first.
Yeah, so he made this in time to go. He went. He was coming back. He left it in the overhead bin on American Airlines, and the original panel was never seen again. Somebody has it. After he died, his mother had a picture of him holding the quilt in Washington, and the panel that's on the quilt is a panel his mother made that's the exact
recreation.
Exact recreation. Dwayne was a sweet kid. He was, he was 22 in 1987, and he died maybe 1990, so he was 25. No, it had to be after that, because it's next to Don Wiener. Don died in 1993, I believe. So, I know half the people on this particular panel. It's one of the most requested panels on the quilt, and certainly one of the most powerful. But that's a way, you know, we were talking before about how do you make just a quilt panel really represent somebody's life. Ugh.
That's incredibly powerful. Yeah.
Cleve, if you could talk a little bit about what do you think about how much attention is paid to HIV and AIDS in general in the media? I mean, you just don't hear that much about it anymore, even though there's not a cure. And do you think that's mainly because of, you know, so much focus on marriage equality?
Well, yes and no. We've moved on. And it's understandable. It's often frustrating. And there's aspects of it that trouble me, but mostly I'm grateful that my friends aren't dropping dead. Mm-hmm. By 1985, almost everyone I knew was dead or dying or caring for someone who was dying. And I don't miss those days at all.
Right.
So I'm... I actually now experience entire days where I don't think about it. And I have it, and I have to take the pills, so I think about it when I'm taking the pills briefly. But there's entire days when I don't think about HIV. There's entire months sometimes when no one I know has a serious health issue related to HIV. Whereas before, I was burying people every week, and that's not an exaggeration or rhetorical. I was burying friends every week for over 10 years. So I'm grateful that that has left us. And I believe that the medications will continue to improve and be more effective and less toxic. I believe that eventually we will find a cure. I think it's possible that I will see that in my lifetime, since I seem to have witnessed a great many other unexpected happy occurrences in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. So I don't beat myself up or the community up for not having it in the front of our minds every single moment. You can't sustain that level of engagement anyway. But the fight's not over, and there's things we still need to be fighting for. But it's interesting that you ask about marriage equality, because I'm hearing all sorts of odd things about the focus on marriage equality. Mm-hmm. And from young people sometimes I hear that we've been directed to focus on marriage equality instead of other issues, or that marriage equality was pushed by the big national organizations as because it was good for raising money and all of that. And I don't agree with any of that. And I am old school. I want to be clear on that. I'm old school. If you had, when I signed up, we called it the Gay Liberation Front. Mm-hmm. And if you had suggested to me in 1972 that 40 some years later I'd be fighting for the right to get married and join the army, well, I probably would have tried dating women, because we were about smashing the patriarchy and ending all war forever. Mm-hmm. So. On my to-do list, my bucket list never included getting married or being a soldier. I remember the good old days when straight boys pretended to be gay to get out of the army.
And it was tough to do. Because,
yeah, how did you prove it?
Let's just not even go there. But in reality, the focus on marriage equality, in my opinion, came out of our community's experience with the pandemic. And we as a people, despite all the differences between us, collectively said, what do you mean this isn't a marriage?
I agree.
What do you mean this isn't a family? After all we have been through, you think we're going to settle for some half-assed, what did Justice Ginsburg call it?
2% milk.
2%, yeah, you know, a 2% marriage. And so I think that there was this new resolve, and that for those of us that were there at the beginning of the pandemic, we feared that this was going to cost us everything, that our movement would be destroyed, that the advances would be rolled back. Instead, the opposite happened. People came out. People signed up. People did more than any human being should ever be expected to have to do in his or her lifetime, and it moved us forward. So even during that horrendous full decade where we had no treatments, our community moved forward, and out of that came this real commitment to actual equality, not fractions of equality, not some, you know, patchwork of inequality. We said, we want it all. And then I think one of the reasons I'm so grateful that I lived long enough to see November of 2008, because in my mind, that's when everything changed again. And so if you wanted to have that be the ending of a chapter and the beginning of a new one, it's November of 2008, because there were three things that happened. Barack Obama showed us that real change is possible in this country. And I am annoyed with President Obama on a number of issues. I am a cynical person, and you can be as cynical as you want about President Obama, but his election was a big deal.
Sure.
And it will be viewed as a big deal 200 years from now.
Yes.
In the history books.
Point.
And for my generation to see a black man in the White House is still an extraordinary and positive and wonderful development. And the same day that that happened, young people in particular, I don't know if I can say this on your show, but got bitch slapped with the reality of Prop 8. And I mean, I heard it from so many young people who actually believed that we were equal. Mm-hmm. And then on that same day that Obama wins in California, gay people lost. And then a few weeks after the election, the film came out, Milk. Mm-hmm. And it reminded an older generation of what we'd fought for. It informed a younger generation of a history they most certainly had not been taught in school. And showed a campaign 30 years before that we'd won without all the black tie dinners and the $1 million media buys, mm-hmm. but with people power going door to door and knocking on the door. Hi, I'm your neighbor. I'm gay. Don't vote for this. It'll hurt me. So
right.
At that point, I and many of my closest friends began to have conversations about what do we do with this energy? And it was so exciting for me to see all of these young people. Remember the Join the Impact protests, mm-hmm. and all the kids using social media really for the first time for our cause in a really effective mm-hmm. way, and watching this momentum build. And then a number of conversations began to happen. And out of those conversations came a sort of a refocusing strategy on federal action. And that was terribly significant. And it really, there's a lot of parallels between the conversations we were having at the end of 2008 and beginning of 2009. There were similar conversations going on in the traditional civil rights movement in 1962, 1963, 1964, when the great heroes of that time understood clearly that they would have to continue to fight in places like Birmingham and Montgomery and Selma, but set their sights on Washington and mm-hmm. the Voting Rights Act and federal action, which finally made it the law of the land. It didn't end racism, of course, but it said that, you know, the law of the land is that race-based discrimination is illegal. So there was a shift. And one of the things that's been interesting about, and I think for all of us that have done activism for a long time, is that so much in the LGBT community, we tear each other apart. We question every action. That won't work. That's too expensive. That won't work. Oh, writing letters to the editor, that won't work. Registering voters, that's not enough. Protesting, that doesn't work. Barney Frank told me, don't march. The only thing you're impressing is the lawn. And it's crap, because the reality is that all of these actions work if you've got the basics. And we've always had the basics right. Come out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Build coalitions, be part of the broader movement, and be relentless. And I think that's the thing I'm most proud of. I've endured through all of these decades. Mm-hmm. I've just kept doing it, and I've learned that all of these tactics work. You know, if you don't feel like protesting, write a letter to the editor. If mm-hmm. you don't want to do that, go register voters. If you don't want to do that,
volunteer at an AIDS food pantry.
At the food pantry.
Yeah.
Do something.
Yeah.
Participate.
Yeah.
Build the community.
You got to come at it from all angles.
Yeah.
Do you know, I was so proud of our community a few weeks ago because of the sequester first and now the shutdown, the North Texas Food Bank, 1 week, do you know what they had on their list of what the local food pantries could order? Nail polish. How much nail polish can you eat? So I know, it's like, why did they even stock that? But that was it. They were out of food, period. So I put something in the paper about the food pantry needs food. Now, this was on a week where the discussion was how people were going to dress for the Pride Parade. And
we got
hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of comments and calls and emails and everything else. I put this letter in, or this little blog post in, about the shelves at the food pantry are bare. Our food pantry gives out 7 tons of food a week. In one weekend, between the Dallas Bears and Leather Knights and Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence and Congregation
Bethel Bena
and Cathedral of Hope, and then just individuals in Stonewall, all of these groups got together. We stocked the pantry for 2 weeks in one weekend. It was like we got it right. Our community got together and said, no. You know.
Yeah, if we stop squawking and just get to work, we, it's amazing what we can accomplish. Mm-hmm. I'm still in awe of what the community is capable of doing.
Yeah.
And I can see, too, and just looking on Facebook, where our straight allies are the ones today. I mean, a lot of us in Texas are having a lot of windy stuff on our profile pages and our profile pictures and covers and cover pictures and stuff. But a lot of our allies all over the country are still doing the red equal sign or some form of it. And I just think that's tremendous. Our allies are there with us and still going. They're persevering, even when we've moved on to other issues. And I just think that's spectacular.
Yeah. Time to take a break? We have 1 minute. We're talking to Cleve Jones. You're going to be at the Interfaith Peace Chapel at 1 o'clock. People can come by and have a conversation with you, just meet you, hear about your – they can listen to you rant and rave.
Squawk,
how's that?
Squawk, squawk.
And squawk. At 5 o'clock, there's a cocktail party there, so you can come. And
yeah, I'd like to meet some nice Texans.
And don't forget about
Tejanos as well.
He's single. He does not want to get married.
The great love of my life I met in Austin, Texas, at the March on Austin, whenever that was.
We've had many.
We've had the first had one. The first one. That was like 1989,
89, I think.
It's an odd year. It had to be an odd year because the legislature.
It was 87. I was there at that.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking to Cleve. We'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
KNON and Beyond Bows and Arrows' 5th Ever Benefit Powwow is coming Saturday, October 5th. It's a free admission powwow with raffles, auctions, Indian food, arts and crafts, as well as raffle dances and spot dances. Vendor space is available. The 5th Ever KNON Benefit Powwow takes place at Four Winds Park, located at 5380 East Highway 199 in Springtown, Texas. MCs for the powwow will be KNON's own Albert O. Crow and Harold Rogers. All drums and princesses are welcome. Vendor setup is at noon. Gourd dance starts at 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. A free supper break from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. and intertribal dancing from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. For vendor space or more information on the powwow, call 972-835-1590. Once again, 972-835-1590. Come experience a traditional old-style benefit powwow Saturday, October 5th.
KNON and RDG Productions presents Greg A. Smith Love Expression CD Release Party this Saturday night at Port David's Pub. It will be a night of love and passion designed with you in mind. This is Greg A. Smith with a personal invitation for you to come out and celebrate with me. I'll be performing with my band along with Leroy Ward and his band, Chester Burns, and Fort Worth's own The Sensational Miss Peaches. A free buffet by Bubba's Fat Burgers and Barbecue, along with Love Expression raffles throughout the night. VIP suites are available at 469-471-4180. That's Greg A. Smith's Love Expression CD Release Party this Saturday at Port Davis Pub, 1313 South Lamar in Dallas. Doors open at 7, show starts at 8. Tickets available at knon.org, Bill's Records, Annie Lane's Kitchen in Dallas, Weber Young Records in Grand Prairie, and Comp Cleaners in Fort Worth. This will be a night for lovers to remember. Sponsored by RDG Productions, this is a KNON benefit concert.
Want to find out about upcoming events at KNON? Want to see pictures from past events or need information about the station? Then you need to like the official KNON Facebook page. It's easy to find. Just go to facebook.com/KNON893. It's the KNON 89.3 FM station-produced page for Facebook. It's the easiest way to keep up with what's going on here at KNON. Like us and share with your friends today. That's facebook.com/KNON893. Accept no substitutions.
Hi, this is Candy Markham, and I listen to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. Listen.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Laurent Landis, the late Patty Fink, and our guest is Cleve Jones, the creator of the quilt.
Cleve, before the show, we talked about, I guess, this conversation that's been around for past 5 or so years about the end of the gayborhoods and how it has changed in a lot of cities. So I had asked you specifically about the Castro area and has it really changed? And, you know, but you talked about how just you go everywhere and things have just gotten better. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think things have really progressed, and it would be silly not for us not to acknowledge that. But there's some very odd and interesting and complicated things happening right now that are of concern to me and also speak to the issue of what's the larger agenda for the movement at this time. The gayborhoods is a really interesting part of that conversation because the gayborhoods aren't just a place where we socialize and come together, but the gayborhoods have been the base of our political power. Mm-hmm. It's the gayborhoods with the precincts that were predominantly LGBT that elected LGBT and LGBT-friendly politicians mm-hmm. who passed the legislation mm-hmm. that has improved the quality of our lives. So you asked me before the show whether the Castro was still gay, and it is. It's full of gay people, but it's a different type of gay people. It's rich people. Mm-hmm. My one-bedroom apartment is $2,250 a month, and that is considered a deal. That's a bargain.
I would venture to say mortgage, don't equal that.
No, okay, to buy a house, to buy a one-bedroom condo in San Francisco, you're looking at $800,000, $900,000. Mm-hmm. So in DuPont Circle, Washington, in the Castro in West Hollywood, in Chelsea, in other, even now in Hell's Kitchen in Manhattan, if it, a gayborhood, it's very, very expensive. So one of the issues facing my generation and that I wish the big national organizations would take on is the question of senior housing. Mm-hmm. Our movement was largely a youth movement for a very long time. Well, I'm getting old, and I want to know where I'm going to live.
So is Patty.
Right now, I'm have you looked in the mirror lately, brother?
Thank you. Thank you.
You know,
go Cleve.
I mean, I'm concerned about this because I have lived in San Francisco in the Castro for most of the last 40 some years. It's where my friends are. It's where my extended family is. It's where my doctor is. It's where I get proper health care. If I move someplace else, I'm going to be hitting 70 in a place where I have no personal support mm-hmm. network, nor am I likely to have access to the kind of quality health care that's kept me alive and going all of these years. But there's other things. There's other forces. The bars. In San Francisco, in the 1970s, we had three times as many gay bars as we do today. Mm-hmm. In San Francisco in the 70s, we had 12 thriving, popular lesbian bars. Today, there are zero. There's club nights for women at various venues.
Wow. Thursday night for women.
Yeah, kind of but thing. That's it. And so why did that happen? Well, I think part of it is the internet and that guys who want to go out and just have sex don't need to go to a bar anymore. They can go on Grindr or some other app and find that way. Also, it's the consequences of integration. We are not a separate, ostracized people anymore. So one of the odd things for me is like my favorite bar in the Castro, my little neighborhood dive bar that I've been going to, I mean, through I don't know how many different owners and names over the decades, it's my bar, and I can't even go there on weekends anymore because it's full of straight people from the suburbs mm-hmm. in my bar.
So we really have gone mainstream.
I'm outraged. But, there's several issues that the national groups are not addressing. One of them is aging. And in San Francisco, just recently, we've started having town hall meetings that are being organized by my generation of long-term survivors. We want to be at the table. And the biggest issue for San Francisco for gay San Franciscans of my generation is housing. You were you had a travel agency.
Yes.
Do you remember now Voyager out of San Francisco?
Yes.
One of the first gay community travel agencies. The founder of that, a very long friend of mine, along with Peter Green. You know, he committed suicide this year after his third eviction.
Wow.
So we're seeing a wave of suicides now among older people who simply don't see that there's a place
for them,
for us to live. Oh. It's very frightening. Oh.
He was one of the founders of ILGTA, the International Gay and Lesbian Travel Association, and we were, I think it was 8 travel agencies from around the country that started. He was one of them.
And so his business partner, Peter Green, is still around, and he's been speaking out more and more. In San Francisco, people are being forced out, and this isn't just San Francisco. It's happening in other big cities, and in particular, it's happening in the gayborhoods.
Well, here in Dallas, they started encroaching on Oak Lawn, and in order to market it to the straight community, that part of Oak Lawn is now uptown, because Oak Lawn has this bad name. Yeah, and I always say, look at the city plat, that's Oak Lawn.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in the mid-90s, I lived in the in D.C. for a year, and DuPont was very gay. Well,
yeah,
we went back, you know, waiting on my daughter to be born a few years back, and it looks like a totally different place. Yeah. I think there was one gay bar in DuPont.
One thing I want to talk about, you're involved in the labor movement right now. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
So my job is
A job.
Yeah, I actually have a job. I work for an organization called Unite Here, which is the hotel workers union. And so we represent the workers in the big hotels in Las Vegas and New York and San Francisco and Toronto and Honolulu and other places.
And not Texas.
And, not in Texas. And so my job is to try to build the coalition between the LGBT movement and the labor movement. And part of that is a campaign I'm doing called Sleep with the Right People, which is encouraging gay travelers and event planners to use union hotels, hotels that have union contracts and respect their workers. It's also about bringing the labor movements getting them more involved. My union was the first union to pass a comprehensive resolution in support of full equality and all matters governed by civil law for LGBT and T people. And, you know, a lot of people don't really understand why the unions are so important, but they're very important. No matter if you're a progressive, if you're a liberal, if you care about fighting racism or saving the environment or quality public education, you better support the unions because it's the unions that pay for the candidates that support those causes. And that's just the way it is. It's also interesting right now that We were able to get the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy overturned, and we're clearly moving towards a complete nationwide victory on marriage equality, but we still don't have ENDA. And if you look in particular at the transgender people in our community, then, you know, if you talk to any transsexual or transgender person, the top three issues are personal safety, access to health care, and jobs, jobs, jobs. If you talk to queer kids, our young people are, you know, disproportionately unemployed. So I'm happy that, you know, I've been able to be part of bringing those two movements together. And in Arizona, for example, our union ran a voter registration drive that brought 35,000 new Latino voters onto the voting roll.
Nice.
So
there you go.
We're really into building coalitions. And, you know, this all, in my mind, it all goes back to what Harvey Milk taught me. Harvey was very much about gay people and fighting for LGBT rights. We didn't use the letters LGBT then, but, you know, that was very much a focus for him. But he also cared about senior citizens. He cared about street kids. He cared about union people. He cared about environmentalists. He saw it as part of a larger movement that we were part of and where we had a responsibility to all of the other parts of this broader movement. So I'm so proud to be part of Unite Here. Unite stands for the United Needle Trade and Industrial Textile Employees. That part of the union grew out of the old International Ladies Garment Workers Union. And then HERE is the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Union.
And
I go back.
Interesting, the person who created the quilt.
And I go back, you know, my relationship with them goes back to the 1970s. Yeah. But I've been working for the International Union for the last decade. And when we win victories, it's really exciting because in a non-union hotel, if you're staying at a non-union Hyatt hotel, the ladies that clean those rooms, and those women are really the backbone of the hospitality industry, they can be expected to clean up to 30 rooms for minimum wage with no health care, and they're treated with disrespect. When we win and they get a contract, they get a lot more money, they get a lot more respect, they can support their families. And it's great on our picket lines to see gay and straight and young and old and black and brown and white all fighting for the same cause, native-born and immigrant. So, you know, that's what I learned from Harvey, that it's a big movement that's been going on for many, many, many generations all across the world, wherever ordinary people stand together for peace and for social justice and for freedom. And I think gay people have made a big contribution that goes way beyond the confines of our own community. And we should all be proud of that and do what we can to continue that work. And if there's people that are listening who agree with that, you know, I would say find a way to contribute that you enjoy, because I love what I do. I really love it. And because I love it, I've been able to stick with it for a long time and see these amazing changes that we've witnessed in our own lifetime that came about because of just ordinary people like us who believed in it. And so find a way to contribute, and find a way to contribute that brings you joy and love and happiness, because we want you to be happy. That's the whole point of all of this, is for people to be happy and love each other and take care of each other.
And it's a great way to meet people, too. I mean, people say, oh, I'm just never going to find the right person. So, well, do what you love, because if you're being happy anyway, then you probably meet other people that have sort of the same passions you do.
Sure. You know, people always ask us, you've been doing that show for 30 years. How do you do it? We love it.
Yeah.
We have a ball coming in here.
We do.
You know, it's kind of like I have to tell myself it's okay to take off an occasional Saturday morning and do something else. But we love it.
We're running out of time, but I just wanted, if you could share the story that you shared with us before the show. Patty, you know, we brought up that Wendy Davis had made her announcement. She is running for governor. And that led into a discussion about our past female governor, Ann Richards. And you know Ann, where you knew Ann Richards. How so?
Oh, I met Ann several times. Texas was very kind to me in the early days of the quilt. People, I think, often forget it, but Dallas and Houston and San Antonio and Austin were very, very hard hit. And so I visited Texas a lot, and Governor Richards was gracious enough to speak at my birthday party in October 11th. I was born on National Coming Out Day, October 11th.
Oh, that's cool.
Very cool. So she spoke at my birthday party in 1996 in Washington with the quilt. And at the time, I was desperately in love with this young man named David Jackson in Houston. He'll probably hear about this now. Great. But, I mean, he was just so cute, and I just had such a thing for him, and he worshipped Governor Richards. So we all ended up at my table at my birthday party, and I whispered to the governor that David was very impressed by her, and, you know, could she please put in a good word for me and tell him he should come to San Francisco with me? And she said, Cleve Jones, are you asking me to pimp for you?
Oh, that's awesome.
Love it.
She was great. So I hope everybody will get behind Wendy Davis, because this state needs a woman governor in the worst way.
We do. We absolutely
right.
do. It's not fast
so
enough.
So many things we could say about that.
So I want people to come and see me. So I'm doing this thing at 1 o'clock.
At 1 o'clock,
which is where?
Two blocks from here. Interfaith Peace Chapel.
Interfaith Peace Chapel at 1 o'clock.
At 1 o'clock,
in an hour.
You'll be there for an hour and a half, 2 hours. 4 hours, then at about 2 hours, and then at 5 o'clock there's a cocktail party with Cleve tomorrow morning for those of you who don't drink.
Where's the cocktail party?
Same place.
Same place.
Also the Interfaith Peace Chapel.
Okay, and then tomorrow morning I'm at Cathedral of Hope.
For both services.
At some appalling hour. What time are you?
9 o'clock on a Sunday morning.
9 o'clock.
You know, it's I know, I don't get it either. So,
And 11 o'clock. Yeah, there are two services. The 11 o'clock service.
I think I'm going to make the 11 o'clock service.
See, but you're doing this right. I remember years ago when we did our annual protest against ExxonMobil, mm-hmm. and we did this big rally at Rivershawn Park, and you know, someone came up and said, you'd have a lot more people if you had cocktails. You know, it's true. So you're doing this right. Cocktail reception at 5.
And I'm on Facebook, and I always love hearing from people on Facebook.
Great. Cleve, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
We're just about out of time. We have 2 minutes. Okay. I really do want to thank you for being here. You know, our first person, gay person who ran for city council, modeled his race. This is Bill Nelson, modeled his race play by play after Harvey Milk. And watching the film, I was just, you know, I was a young person in Bill Nelson's campaign, so I was just doing what they told me to do. But
Must have been a long time ago.
It was a long time ago.
You are. So,
you know. Oh, that's terrible.
You know, just watching the film, I'm going, we did that. Oh, that's where we got that from. You know, and it was even things like, because it was a not a precinct race, it was a city, pulling people out of the bathhouses and driving them over to the polls. Harvey did that. That's where we got it from. Everything, play by play, right out of Harvey's playbook. Watching that film, to me, it was so personal. If you haven't seen that film, go rent it,
and
download it, whatever you need to do.
And Cronenberg's now in the newsroom on Showtime.
Yeah.
So. Just kidding. Alison Pill, who portrayed Ann Kramer,
who played her? Yeah, yeah. Harvey.
Oh Lord,
Cleve.
Thank Cleve you Jones. So much for being with us. My pleasure. Thank you,
and have a good weekend here in Dallas. We'll be back with more Lambda Weekly next week.